Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and this edition is published in the earlier hours of Wednesday the 23rd of October. Our main stories.
The eyes to the right, 308. The nose to the left, 322.
Defeat for the British Prime Minister means he's unlikely to meet his pledge to get Brexit done by next week.
I must express my disappointment that the House has again voted for delay, rather than a timetable that would have guaranteed that the UK would be in a position to leave the EU on October the 31st.
He may now try to call a snap general election. One other story, Kurdish fighters in northern Syria have been given 150 hours to withdraw 30 kilometres from the Turkish border. Also in the podcast.
People affected by dementia have been waiting over 15 years for new treatments in this area, and we're yet to see a drug that can really slow the progression of the disease. If this indeed does become the first disease-modifying treatment, we really hope that that opens the floodgates.
Could this be a major breakthrough in the treatment of Alzheimer's? And the lasting effects of tear gas. But first to the momentous events in the British Parliament, where more than 3 years after the UK's 52-48% vote in favour of leaving the EU, MPs have for the first time backed a departure deal.
The ayes to the right, 329. The noes to the left, 299.
To the right, 329. The nose to the left, 299. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Unlock.
So the agreement Boris Johnson struck with his fellow European leaders passed its second reading in the House of Commons by a majority of 30. However, the bill still needs to get through further hurdles, and the next question was whether Parliament would agree to the government's plan of getting it all done in just over 2 days. And this time, the majority was against.
The ayes to the right, 308. The noes to the left, 322.
The ayes to the right, 308. The noes to the left, 322. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock.
That defeat meant it was very unlikely that Mr. Johnson would be able to meet his loudly trumpeted deadline to leave the EU by the 31st of October, just 8 days' time. Do or die, come what may, as he put it. In response to the defeat, he said he would pause the legislation until he heard back from the European Union about a possible extension.
I must express my disappointment that the House has again voted for delay, rather than a timetable that would have guaranteed that the UK would be in a position to leave the EU on October the 31st with a deal. And we now face further uncertainty, and the EU must now make up their minds over how to answer Parliament's request for a delay.
For his part, the leader of the main opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, said he was willing to enter negotiations with the government.
Tonight, the House has refused to be bounced into debating a hugely significant piece of legislation in just 2 days, with barely any notice and an analysis of the economic impact of this bill. The Prime Minister is the author of his own misfortune. So I make this offer to him tonight. Work with us, all of us, to agree a reasonable timetable, and I suspect this House will vote to debate, scrutinise, and I hope amend the detail of this bill. That would be the sensible way forward, and that's the offer I make on behalf of the opposition tonight.
But that seems unlikely. So where do we go from here? Our political correspondent Rob Watson has been following events in Westminster.
I think we have maybe a tiny bit more clarity in the sense that before these historic votes, there were three possibilities. One was that the UK would leave the EU with the deal that Mr Johnson had negotiated on the 31st of October, as he had promised. The second option was that, yes, you'd leave with that deal, but there would be some kind of delay. It would take Parliament longer, so maybe the middle of November. And then the third option is that the whole process would collapse, Parliament couldn't agree a deal, and that there would be a general election. So it seems to me that option one is now firmly out. And so we're left with two or three, Brexit with this deal, but with some delay, or a general election. And the sort of signs we've been getting from Downing Street suggest that they're more inclined to a general election.
And yet they did, for the first time, get a deal endorsed in that second reading in Parliament. So doesn't that suggest they could get this deal through if they had a bit more time?
Yes, it does. And that's why I'm not entirely ruling out that second option of going back to Parliament, saying, OK, let's see if we can do this in a matter of weeks rather than days. So Mr Johnson crashes his deadline of the 31st of October, but then gets the deal in maybe the middle of November or the end or something like that. So it's absolutely not out of the question. But I think it's worth remembering that although there was a majority for the idea of this deal, obviously what the government would be fearing is that opposition MPs, they don't agree with every bit of the deal. Far from it. I mean, many of them think it's a really lousy deal. They would try to change it, and that in itself would just collapse the process of trying to get a deal.
And if there is an election, when is it likely to be?
Well, one would have to think that it would need to be sooner rather than later, in the sense that Britain does not have a government with a majority. It hasn't settled the issue of Brexit. And you would think that that just could not continue for very long. I mean, I say that. I mean, a lot of people would have thought that you couldn't continue the way the UK has been for the last 3.5 years, and it has. I mean, I think there's no doubt that Mr Johnson eyes a general election with great favour, because he's thinking, right, my message to the electorate is dead clear. He said what that was going to be in Parliament today. He said it's going to be, if you want to get Brexit done, vote Conservative, vote Boris Johnson. And he'll also be aware that he has a pretty substantial lead over the main opposition Labour Party, a Labour Party that also struggles over Brexit, is somewhat demoralised, and is led by someone profoundly unpopular in Jeremy Corbyn. So I think to some extent, Mr Johnson and Downing Street, yes, this was a sort of one step forward and one step back with these votes, but they're sort of thinking, do you know what, bring it on.
Rob Watson in Westminster. So how have the fast-moving events there been seen by other members of the European Union? Well, the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, was one of the first to tweet his reaction, as we heard from our Europe correspondent, Adam Fleming.
The tweet says that he will recommend to the 27 leaders of the other EU countries to accept the UK request for an extension, and that they should do it using the written procedure. Now, the second half of the tweet means that they're going to do this with an exchange of letters and emails rather than having to all assemble in Brussels for an emergency summit to make the decision, which very few leaders had any appetite for doing. The first half is a little bit more complicated, though, because when I first read that, I thought, oh, he's basically saying he agrees with the UK request to extend Brexit till the end of January next year. I am told he's not necessarily accepting that date, and actually what he's doing is just moving on the process of consultation with the leaders and agreeing on the process that they'll use to make the decision, not actually the date itself. So we all have to hold our horses a little bit before we say that it's been agreed. And that is why actually they are a bit heartened tonight, because the first vote that happened in Parliament tonight was the first vote ever where a majority of members of Parliament at Westminster supported any kind of Brexit deal. So while we're all focusing on the extension and a potential delay, actually the bit of good news, and I'm using air quotes there for the process, is that there was a majority for the Brexit deal that Boris Johnson negotiated with the EU.
Adam Fleming in Brussels. Other news now, and an American pharmaceutical company says it's developed the first drug able to slow Alzheimer's disease. It works by attacking toxic proteins in the brains of dementia patients. I heard more from our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
What this drug is an antibody, and when you give it to patients, then what it does is it basically attacks and breaks down these toxic proteins that build up in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. And what you see is, if you look at brain scans, you see these toxic proteins building up. They form plaques on the brain, and where you see them, then you start seeing brain cells dying. So the theory is that if you were able to destroy those plaques, those toxic proteins, then you could stop brain cells dying and maybe slow the pace of Alzheimer's disease. And that seems to be what we're saying today.
And there is some surprise at this announcement because they'd already looked at this and had some disappointing results a couple of years
ago. I'll tell you what, I'm really surprised about this too, because this Biogen, the US pharmaceutical company, analysed basically the same set of data in March this year and went, nah, it ain't working. And they basically said, we're going to pull the plug on it. Now, what they've done since is they've had another trial running at the same time, and they've also looked at this data in more detail. So what they've done is they've looked at the patients who were getting the highest doses, who were basically getting the most of this drug. And they showed that those patients did have a benefit. So this isn't, we're not talking about a cure. What we're talking about is slowing the pace of decline, and that's still important. But what they were showing was they had better language ability, they had better memory, they were better at day-to-day tasks like doing the laundry, putting their clothes on, getting out and about, than people who were not taking the high doses of this drug. So they were starting to see a very clear difference between patients who were treated and those who weren't.
Now, we often hear about breakthroughs. How significant is this?
If this is true, and I think scientists around the world will say, I want to look at the data, because the drug company has said, we've got this and this is the scale of the improvement, but they will want to see the minutiae of that data to be 100% sure. But everyone I have spoken to today has been incredibly excited. That has included really significant players in the field of dementia. And there is no doubt that if this is the first drug that slows the pace of any dementia, and Alzheimer's is the biggest dementia, then that would be one of the biggest days in medicine, period. Because Alzheimer's disease and dementia are the biggest problem in Western countries. They're untreatable. There is not a single drug you can take that can slow the course of that disease. So if it does work, and it's a big if, then it would be a huge moment that is actually incredibly hard to understate.
James Gallagher. And still to come in the podcast, why the final of this year's Asian Football Cup is being moved from North Korea to China. Turkey and Russia have done a deal to carve up part of northern Syria after Donald Trump's controversial decision to pull US troops out of the area and leave his former Kurdish allies to the mercy of a Turkish invasion. The Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Vladimir Putin thrashed out the agreement at lengthy negotiations in the Russian resort of Sochi, as I heard from our correspondent there, Sarah Rainsford.
It was an extremely long talk. We'd been told in advance that this was going to be a complex process. And certainly Presidents Erdogan and Putin, as they came out of their very, very long meeting, looked extremely serious-faced, very earnest. But they had come out with an agreement that does appear to suit both countries. Now, this deal, essentially, the two key points, I think, on it. One is about the central part of the border zone where Turkish forces launched their military operation a couple of weeks ago against Kurdish militias there. In that central part of the border zone, the status quo will remain. That means that Turkish troops will remain. That means that Kurdish militias who've been pushed back to 30 kilometres must remain that far back. But outside of that zone, where there had been concerns that Turkey would want to expand what it's described as a buffer zone, a safe zone area, to essentially to expand its military operations, instead of that, Syrian forces and Russian military police forces will patrol together in those other areas of the Syrian-Turkish border. So an agreement which prevents Turkey from pushing any further militarily and gives Syrian government forces and their Russian backers the right to return to very significant areas of Syria where they haven't been for a long, long time.
And I guess it's important that they get control quickly, because we've just heard from Russia's defence minister that up to 500 people held in prisons for Islamic State fighters in northern Syria have escaped. So it's vital they get in there.
Well, certainly, a lot of this discussion has been shaped in terms of anti-terrorist strategies, whether it's about Turkey talking about the PKK's links with the Kurdish militia in Syria and its security concerns, or indeed, as you say, the prisoners of ISIS who've been up until now in facilities guarded by Kurdish militia and Kurdish forces in that area. So both of those issues were discussed. Both Turkey and Russia also talking about the fact that in the long term, they want both of them to see Syrian refugees who've moved particularly into Turkey itself moving back to this area. So they're looking to the long term stability of this zone. But, you know, I think what has been interesting watching this all here in Sochi on the Black Sea is just watching how Russia's role in resolving the crisis moments in Syria and the broader political picture in that country has just grown and grown. You know, it's notable that it was here to Russia that President Erdogan came from Turkey, and the two sides, as I say, do appear to have struck a deal that suits both of them, increasing Russia's role and also securing the security that Turkey says is essential to it.
Sarah Rainsford in Sochi. So what's happening on the ground in northeastern Syria itself? Well, as the original five-day truce was coming to a close, the US said that Kurdish fighters had pulled out as demanded. But how do they feel about the Turkey-Russia deal? Ali Makbul has been reporting from Syria in recent days. He's now in Erbil, capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, with reaction there.
The Kurds already feel they have fulfilled their obligations under the initial ceasefire agreement, many were calling it, in that they withdrew from this conflict zone of around 100 kilometres between two strategic towns, Ras Al Ain and Tal Abyad. So they already felt they had done that. What this new agreement between Russia and Turkey says is that there will be patrols right along the Turkey-Syria border, and during the next week, Kurdish forces will have to withdraw from those areas as well. So I was inside that part of Syria a couple of days ago and spoke to members of the Kurdish forces there, and they felt resigned to doing essentially anything they were told right now, simply to give civilians there some respite from the terrible violence that they faced over the last week or so. So they have already withdrawn from those areas. It feels like they will withdraw from other areas as well. But they essentially feel, the Kurds, that Turkey is getting the very objectives it set out with when it started its offensive, its invasion into Syria. And the Kurds feel that the international community is, in a sense, reinforcing Turkey's aims.
Ali Makbul in Erbil. Next to a sound that's been heard lots during the recent protests in Hong Kong. Well, that is the police firing tear gas. It's generally seen as a non-lethal measure to tackle unrest. But does it have a long-term health impact? Hong Kong Secretary for Food and Health, Sophie Chan, has rejected fears over the impact of gas on air and water quality. There are no irregularities from June until now, she said on local radio. Dr. Anna Feigenbaum is the author of Tear Gas, From the Battles of World War I to the Streets of Today.
Tear gas is a word that we use to refer to various chemical compounds. The most famous ones are CS and OC. CS is usually what we call tear gas, and OC is pepper spray, but both of those get referred to under this umbrella term of tear gas. And what they are chemical compounds that get released into the air or through a spray. And when they affect someone's body, they cause sensory damages. So we see things like runny noses, watering eyes, where they get their name from, difficulty breathing, and they also can get into the skin. So that's where we sometimes see reports of rashes, burning sensations. And the other thing that's important about them is that they get fired or shot in one form through canisters and grenades, and those often can sort of hit people. And so we normally, when we see about tear gas in the news, it's usually one of those kinds of things that are happening, the big clouds that are delivering the chemicals, or these canisters that we see firing out into the streets.
So when we hear from the Secretary for Food and Health, Sophia Chan, allaying fears of the deployment of tear gas and the kind of potential prolonged impact of it, is she right?
In terms of medical literature, tear gas in a public health kind of crowd situation is incredibly difficult to study because of the chaotic conditions and how difficult it is to do data collection. So everybody who writes about this in leading medical journals and their peer-reviewed articles will say that. But there have still been many, many studies done. And the Lancet article that Sophia was responding to was citing one of these studies that was actually a massive study of lots of other studies that had been done. And that really does a good job of chronicling all the different kinds of injuries that we know that tear gas can have in a range of severity, from mild that do pass to the more severe and the life-threatening. And politically, this is important because tear gas was actually brought to the law enforcement market because of its ability to disappear. you can find in early promotional materials people saying, we've got this great stuff. It leaves no traces of blood and bruises like other weapons, yet it works particularly against passive resistance.
It's quite clear that there is harm that is done, that the issue is whether it's prolonged and whether it's just done to human beings. I mean, there must be an impact in terms of agriculture, just the general air that's breathed in.
We have some studies that have looked at places that get tear gas repeatedly, such as in Palestine, where you can see damage to agricultural as well as to animal life from that prolonged exposure. There's been some studies that were done after the mass tear gassing during Occupy Gezi in Turkey, also looking at particularly the damage to animals that were around. The air quality question is a complicated one. You know, tear gas was made so that it would dissipate from the air in a kind of 48 to 72 hour time period. And when you already have very polluted air, trying to figure out how long that those chemicals are lingering in the air is an incredibly difficult task.
Dr. Anna Feigenbaum talking to Razia Iqbal. The final of this year's Asian Football Cup has been moved from North Korea to China. The authorities said the match between North Korea and Lebanon early next month would now be played in Shanghai. They said commercial partners had advised them of the challenges involved. Catherine Davis reports.
In a statement, the Asian Football Confederation said it had been compelled to shift the game to a neutral venue. The decision, it said, followed careful consideration of the challenges affecting commercial broadcasting and logistical arrangements. Last week, Pyongyang hosted a World Cup qualifying match between North and South Korea, but did not allow it to be televised live or any fans or foreign media to attend. Among a handful of spectators was the FIFA president, who said he was disappointed and surprised to see the empty stadium.
Catherine Davis. A group of hitmen in China have been jailed after trying numerous times to subcontract a killing. They were convicted of attempted murder by a court in Nanning in Guangxi. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen told me what happened.
Well, this is a case that's been going on for some time, and it all started about 3 years ago when this businessman called Tan Youhui decided that he wanted to take out one of his competitors, a man surnamed Wei. His full name isn't given. And in order to do so, he hired a hitman and paid him $282,000 in order to take out Mr. Wei. But the man chickened out and he decided instead to subcontract the job to somebody else. So
Another hitman.
So he paid another hitman half the price, thinking he could take some of the money himself, to kill Mr. Wei. And this subcontracting happened five times, each time the price getting lower and lower and lower to the final man, who was only charged about $1,400 in order to kill Mr. Wei.
For an original price that was $282,000. And did he actually carry out the job?
He didn't, no. I mean, for that price as well. So what he did instead was he actually approached the man he was meant to kill and said, could we fake your own death? So they staged some photographs and Mr. Wei went along with it, but then went to the police. All five of the men who were in this line of subcontracting and the businessman ended up going to court. This is a story that's had a lot of amusement online. People have said it's like a film on the popular platform Sina Weibo, which people use instead of Facebook or Twitter. The discussion of how seemingly unprofessional they were to chicken out and to subcontract the job to somebody else for a smaller price.
Kerry Allen. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.